discussion section tomorrow, where he's going to help. Tomorrow's discussion section will be just open office hours, okay, for homework, project, whatever else you need to ask. All right, so what we are going to do today is basically have a short class. I'll talk about disk scheduling and mass storage, and then I will give you guys a sneak peek at the next programming assignment. If you really want to get started early, you will have it today. I'm officially going to put it up tomorrow, or maybe the day after. But I'll show you where to go to get the URL that is not going to be linked until it's really final. Okay, so bonus for coming to class. Alright. So homework, you can hand it to me here. There's a drop box in the main office. If you need a little bit more time, just go there, drop it off, and we'll pick it up from there. Okay? You can email it if you really want to. That's fine too. Alright. So let's talk about secondary storage. So last time we were, I gave you an overview of what hard drives look like. Okay, so there's a picture there. I don't know if it's visible. So you have a hard disk, basically looks like a CD with multiple platters in a box. Okay, each platter basically has circular tracks on which data is recorded. Okay, tracks are partitioned into sectors. A sector is the smallest granularity of data that can be written or read from a disk. Typically, sector sizes are 512 bytes or thereabout. There's a disk head that needs to move back and forth in order to read data from this disk. Okay, the platter is spinning. The disk head can just move back and forth. So to read a particular sector, it has to be first positioned on the right track, and that incurs what is called a seek. So the disk is seeking to the right track. And then it has to be positioned on the track until the right sector spins by under the head. Okay? That point you can read or write to it. So typically disk IO time is seek time plus the rotational delay plus the transfer time. Okay, transfer time is the time actually spent in reading or writing data. Okay, that's what we talked about. And then we looked at several storage allocation policies. We looked at contiguous file allocation, block allocation where the files are stored as linked list. We looked at index allocation where there's an index node or index structure that has pointers to the disk block of the file, and multi-level index structures, which is what Unix uses. So what we are going to do today is actually go one level down. Okay, so we started with the file interface. This is the interface exposed to the application. Last time we looked at key file system structures. Okay, the index node as well as disk allocation. And today we are going to go one level down and see how data is actually written or read from disks. If you had a question, yes.
Are there any disks that have multiple heads for the same disk? Like, is it possible for you to have more than one head? So
disks have multiple heads, but only one head can be active at any time. You don't have more than one head per surface. Okay, so for each platter, each surface, you only have one head. Okay, but because there are multiple platters, each platter has to have its own disk head. But the way disks are constructed is that only one head can be active. So if the disk is head is reading or platter zero, all the other disk heads cannot do anything. So you cannot parallelize I/O. That's what you're basically asking. If you have multiple heads, you can read or write in parallel. That is not done.
Well, even not in parallel, but just to remove the seek option, like, is it possible to just put a head on each instance of the disk, just so that you don't have to do the seek time, you just have to choose the head?
Well, people were designing disk drives back in the 60s and 70s, there were many different forms they thought of. The one was a cylinder structure. Okay? Rather than having a platter, there's a cylinder, and the cylinder rotates, and there are disk heads everywhere. Okay, so you basically just activate the right head, and you also write in circles, and you just read or write from that track, which is exactly what you're saying. But for whatever reason, these other forms of storage devices didn't become popular. So yes, you can design it, and people actually designed something like this back in the 60s. Okay. So here is what typical disk parameters look like. So I just pulled this off today. These are not the biggest drives you can buy today, but they are fairly modern. Okay, both are Seagate disk drives. Okay, one is a SATA drive. This is the kind of disk drive you see in a typical PC or a laptop. And then there is a SCSI disk, which you still find in servers. Okay, but SATA and other interfaces have taken over. Now, as far as the disk is concerned, there is no difference between the SATA or SCSI. This is just the interface. This is what you use to plug into the disk. Okay? Internally, the disk is exactly the same. It is going to have platters and disk heads and whatnot. This is just the interface. I mean, you could have a USB disk, for example. Okay, that just says how do you plug the disk in. It doesn't change how the disk is constructed internally. Okay, so here's a 160 GB disk. This one has 16 platters, then around 16,000 tracks. Okay, so if you think of a CD, there are 16,000 tracks on that kind of a platter. Okay, so that tells you how fine the disk head has to be in order to read or write data to that platter. Okay, 60 or so sectors, 512 bytes. Typically, you have 7,000 RPM, you get 10,000 RPM and 15,000 RPM disk drives. Okay, this is just how fast the platter is spinning. And seek times and rotational latencies are in 2 to 4 millisecond range these days. Okay. And if the peak transfer rate is in the order of 100 megabytes a second. Okay, once the data is actually pulled off the platter, it goes into on-disk buffer. And from there, you can blast it out at a very high rate. Okay. You cannot sustain this because the disk head eventually has to move somewhere and then the buffer empties out, so you can't really send data at this speed at all times, but this is the peak transfer rate. Okay. And this is the buffer I was talking about. There's an onboard cache, which is basically memory, that holds data that's been read off the platter but that's not yet sent to the PC, or data that's arrived from the operating system which needs to be written out but hasn't written out. So that's where you cache it temporarily and then you send it out. Okay, yes, question there.
I see why the rotational latency is smaller in the SCSI. It's got more RPMs, but why is the average seek time?
So seek time is how quickly the disk can head can move back and forth. Okay. Rotational latency depends on how quickly the disk is spinning. So you see that approximately when you double the rate at which it's spinning, the rotational latency has become half. Okay. But that doesn't mean the disk head is like the same thing you have in a DVD drive or something. So there is a thing that is reading, it just moves back and forth. That's all it can do. Okay. And the only way to reduce this is to make it move back faster. And that I think people have probably reached the limit of the speed at which you can move it. So you cannot get too much improvement on this, but that you can, if you make the disk rotate faster, you will get lower latency. Okay. And also higher transfer rates. Any other questions on this? Okay. So basically, if you want to have a responsive disk, okay, what are things we can do? So obviously we need to reduce the seek time and the rotational latency. The transfer time is basically the only useful work that the disk is doing, where data is actually being read or written. This is essentially wasted work, that the disk head is just moving, trying to position itself at the right location. Now if you want to do high throughput I/O, if you want responsive disks, or you want to do lots high volume disk reads and writes, what can you do, okay, to minimize disk seek time or rotational latency? So one is, you can modify the hardware. Okay, you can make disks smaller. Okay. So if you have 2.5 inch drives or 1.8 inch drives, these are the drives that you get in iPods. Okay, so those are much smaller than the 3 inch drives. Then the platters are smaller, so you can get to them faster. You can make the disk spin faster to reduce the rotational latency. Okay. You can intelligently schedule disk operations in a way to reduce disk head movement. Okay? This is something we are going to look at today. Okay? The other thing you can do is to lay out data such that you minimize disk head movement. So if you store related data on nearby tracks, okay? So this is almost like saying you more or less allocate files contiguously on disk. You don't have to, but even if it's not contiguous, if they are on nearby tracks, and if you are reading the file sequentially, then the disk seek time will be reduced. Okay, because you store one block and the next block is somewhere close to it, then you have to do a short seek. If the next block is somewhere far off, then you have to do a long seek. Okay? So you can reduce seek time by reducing, by storing related data on close by tracks. Even if it's not contiguous, you can store them on nearby track. Okay? You can place commonly used files together and maybe towards the either the beginning of the disk or end of the disk, where it's again clustered together. Okay? We can also pick our sector size. Okay, typically, this is chosen by the hardware. Okay, so when I say we can pick, it means the disk manufacturer can pick. The operating system cannot pick. Okay, so the operating system can pick the block size. Okay, block size is the minimum amount of data you can read or write to the disk. Okay, so now if you pick smaller blocks, that basically say that if a file is 1 kilobytes in size and you pick, let's say, 512 byte block, the file will have two blocks. Okay? So if the two blocks are not stored together, then you will have two seeks to to access this file. But if you have 1 kilobyte blocks, then the entire file is in one block. So you only incur one seek to read the file. Okay? So the block size has a tremendous impact on the throughput that you can get from the file system. Okay? Larger the block size, the higher throughput you can achieve, because more data is stored together. Okay, the data, if the data is stored far apart from one another, then you have more seeks to access data from a single file. The data is clustered together, then you have fewer seeks. Okay, one way to put it together is to have a larger block. Okay, the larger the block, more data gets packed into each block, so fewer seeks you have. Okay. Now, on the other hand, if you have very large block, then you are going to have internal fragmentation. Because block is the granularity of allocation. Okay, let's say you pick 16 kilobyte blocks. Okay? I said the other day that most files are 2 to 4 kilobytes in size. Okay, so most files on your disk drive will be only one block in size. Okay, if you see two 16 kilobyte blocks, then most half or more of that storage space is going to be wasted. So you have to balance between throughput and fragmentation issues. And most file systems choose block sizes in the range of 1 to 4 kilobytes. Okay? There are special cases like video servers. Okay, if you have video files, these are the kinds of files that you have on YouTube servers. Okay? Those are very large files. Okay? So there you can get away by choosing large blocks. You can choose half a megabyte. Or a megabyte block size. So those are the giant blocks, but the files are also larger. Okay, so you can achieve higher throughput of these blocks. Okay. So one thing to keep in mind is a lot of these problems are going to go away in the next 5 to 10 years as hardware manufacturers switch to solid state drives. Okay. But solid state drive don't have this notion of a seek. You can go and read random locations as if you are accessing memory. You just go access whatever location you want in any order. Okay. So these optimizations are not needed. There's nothing spinning there. Okay. It just looks like a large memory region, okay, non-volatile memory region. Okay. So these are only needed for traditional disk drives. So what we are going to do in today's class is look at this part. Okay. This is basically how you allocate storage space. This is basically the file system issue of what algorithm it uses to allocate blocks from the free list. Okay. If it allocates blocks that are close to one another for the same file, then you will get better overall performance, less for a disk fragmentation. Okay, so we will not talk about this, but today we will just see how can you schedule disk head movement to reduce to improve disk throughput. Okay. So the basic problem is as follows. So you have a disk drive, and let's for now just assume that it's a single platter, like a CD drive or a DVD ROM drive. And there are blocks written to it. Okay, and there is a disk head here. Okay. And we'll assume that the OS is just sending IO requests to this device, and requests come and they get queued up. Okay, so you'll basically say block 5 or 7. Okay. Now the question is, how should the disk head service these blocks? Okay. And by doing some intelligent scheduling of IO requests, can we reduce overall disk head movement? Okay. We are going to look at four different algorithms. Okay. The first one is first come first serve or FIFO. We look at something called shortest seek time first, scan and C-scan, and these are basically, as you will see, they are also called elevator algorithms. Okay. So we look at them one at a time. So let's take the simplest one just to understand what the problem is. Okay. This is FCFS, So essentially we have a disk and there are some outstanding I/O requests that have come from the device driver. Okay? Question is, what order do you service them? In FCFS, you just service them in the order in which they are received at the disk. Okay, you don't do any reordering of requests. So if the disk, or rather the device driver or the operating system sends requests for block 65, 40, 18 and 78, then that's the order in which you will service them. Okay? Here we will use track numbers as block numbers. Okay, really what you will have, the request will basically have cylinder, which is the platter, track and sector. Okay, so we'll assume single platter, so this is not even an issue, there's only one cylinder, number is always one. Can we'll ignore the sector size just for simplicity. We'll assume that those numbers there, okay, refer to track numbers and that we want to read the whole track, okay, just for simplicity, but really what you need is the track number and the sector number within the track. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. Okay, so here is basically a layout of this. Now this may not look clear, but let's say these are the track numbers. So track numbers go from 0 to 100. Okay, so if you map it onto a circular thing, this is track 0. Okay, and the outermost track is track 100. Okay, then this is track 1, track 2 and so on. Okay, so we want to access data on track 65, 40, 18 and 78. Okay, so disk head is, where is the disk head? Okay, so you can't see this, but there's a small arrow here. Okay, so that's, so it's assumed that the disk head is currently positioned on track number 30. Okay, so this is track 30. And this is where the current location of the disk head is, and those requests have come in. Okay? So what's the disk going to do? Okay, it's going to move from 30 to track number 65. This is FCFS. It's going to service them in that order. Okay? So it's going to move to track number 65. Okay, so it's going to move out, it'll go to track 65, read its data, then it moves back to track 40. Okay, so then it's going to move back in and go back to track 40. Okay, then it's going to go back in to track 18, and then it's going to move back all the way to track 78. Okay, so I cannot write, but what it will do here, okay, this is the disk head, it's going to move back all the way to 65, move back to 40, move to 18, then go to 78. Okay, so that's the order of seek, 65, 40, 18, 70, and that's the order of request. Okay, now if you compute how much distance the disk head has moved in units of number of tracks, okay, that's the time that you have wasted, okay, doing seeks. So in this case, the distance of seeks is you moved 35 tracks, because you are on track 30, you went to track 65, that's 35 tracks. Then you moved from here to here, then you moved 25 tracks, then you moved from here to here, it's 22 tracks, and you moved from 18 to 78, you moved 60 tracks. Okay, so in other words, to service the sequence of requests, the total distance the disk head has moved is 142. Okay? 142 tracks. Okay, that's the amount of time you wasted doing nothing. And you'll see that other algorithms will do better. Okay, or worse, depending on the algorithm. Okay? Is this clear? What FCFS does? Any questions? Okay. So when does this work well and when does this not work well? Okay, now if I'm clear, the claim is that if you have a lightly loaded system, FCFS is a good option. Why is that? It's also a good option for SSD drives, because SSD drives don't have any seeks, so there's nothing to do there. Okay, so you just service them in whatever order you come in, because you can do instantaneous random access to any location on disk. Okay, but for normal disk drives, the claim is for if the disk is lightly loaded, just do FCFS. Don't have to do anything smarter. Why? Yes?
Because everything is going to be pumped together fairly nicely, so it's not going to be a great business to see. So
no, I didn't mean the disk is not... The disk could be full. It may be full of data. Lightly loaded means there are not many requests coming in to do reads or writes. This could be completely full. Okay. You may have written 160 gigabytes on your disk drive. But so long as you are not accessing that data frequently, meaning that there are only a few requests coming in, then it's okay to use FCFS. Why?
Because you don't have to search through the whole list to find the
Okay, elaborate a little bit. You are on the right track. Any ideas? Yes.
Well, if you're not that busy, then the sea tension really matters too much.
Yes, but why does it not matter?
Because it doesn't happen that often.
Okay, so it doesn't happen that often. So what does that mean? Let me just rephrase what you are saying. Basically, that's the right track. So if you are lightly loaded, that means how many outstanding requests are you likely to have in your queue here? This is the queue of requests that the disk needs to service. In a lightly loaded system, what do you expect this queue to look like?
Close to empty.
Okay, so typically you will have either zero requests, which means the disk is idling, or one request in the queue. Okay, that's basically close to empty means zero or one. So if you only have one request, what is there to schedule? There's nothing you can do. That's the only request that you have to service, so you just service it. That's FCFS. In fact, any scheduling algorithm will degenerate to FCFS. If there's only one request in the queue, it cannot reorder it. There's nothing to reorder. So all scheduling algorithms degenerate to FCFS if you are in a lightly loaded system. So why bother? Right? You just use FCFS in that case. Is this clear? Yes. So now let's try to do something a little smarter. Okay. Next algorithm is SSTF, shortest seek time first. Okay. What this is going to do is it is going to look at the current position of the disk head. And it's going to look at the queue of requests. Okay, let me write that down. We are going to use the same sequence for all our examples. 65, 40, 18, and 78. Okay, these are four requests that have come into the disk. So it is going to look at the current position of the disk and say where is the closest request. Okay, and it's going to service that. Okay, once it has serviced that, it's going to say, I'm now at this location, where is the next closest request, and go service that and so on. This is why you say shortest seek time. Okay, you service that request next, which incurs the shortest seek time. Okay, so if you're at position 30, okay, which of these requests are you going to service first? Yeah, so this is this closest seek because you only have to move 10 tracks. Okay, this one requires 12 tracks. Yeah, this one requires 35 tracks and that requires 48 tracks. So you service 40 first. Okay, now you're done and you are now at location 40. Which one would you do next? Okay, you will do 65 because that's 25 tracks away. And this is more than that. Okay, that is 22 tracks away. So you'll do 18. Okay. Once you've done 18, then you have to do 65 first and then 78. Okay, so that's the order in which you will service these requests. Okay, so that's basically what's said here. 14, 18, 65, 78. So the distance is you move from 30 to 40, that's 10, and 22 to go from here to here, 47 tracks to go to 65, additional 13 tracks. So your total disk head movement is 92. Which is down from 142 in FCFS. Okay? So this, if you use SSTF, you are getting higher throughput. Okay? Because you could service these requests in a shorter amount of time. You did less seek, so you could finish them faster. Okay? You know, so that means you can service more requests in a given period. Okay? Is this clear? So, is this efficient? Typically, yes, because you are trying to minimize disk head movement. So that's a good thing. Okay. Is it optimal? It's not, actually. All it is doing is, it's greedy. Okay, this is a greedy algorithm. Greedy algorithm says, I'm going to always try to service the request that is closest to the disk head. Okay, that's what a greedy algorithm does. So this minimizes seek time, but it doesn't minimize overall cost. Okay, because we have not said anything about rotational latency here. Okay, if you actually look at disk specs, you will see that seek and rotational latency are approximately the same order of magnitude. Okay, each takes 4 milliseconds. We are only optimizing this parameter. We are not optimizing that parameter. Okay? So it's not optimal. An optimal algorithm would basically say, I will service that request next, which takes the minimum seek plus rotational latency. Yeah, so if I give you, let's say, a disk like this and say go access this block, that block, and this block, and this is the current disk head. So it basically has to say I have to go here, 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 here. This is the total time. So that's seek plus rotational latency.
What about just
for seek? For seek, it's optimal because you're doing shortest seek time, right? Well, not optimal, it's greedy. I don't think it's optimal. We'll show us the scan actually does a little better. Right? It's greedy. I mean, it's good, but it's not the best. Let's put it that way. Okay. So this algorithm, which I just pointed here, which we'll not talk about, but it's something that people have looked at, is called shortest access time first, SATF. Because it looks at the total seek plus rotational latency and services that request, which is not closest to the disk head from both seek and rotational latency perspective. Okay. The problem with SSTF is that it can cause starvation. The same problem as shortest job first. Shortest job first said I'm going to greedily pick the shortest job. Okay, so if there's a steady stream of short jobs coming, a long job starts. Same problem. Disk head is basically at 30. So let's say then you get a request for 31. Okay, so you go to 31. Then you get 28. So you are basically just hovering around this position, and there's a request for, let's say, block 90. That never gets serviced because there's always a nearby request I can service. And far off request gets starved. That's not a good algorithm from a fairness perspective because it can cause starvation. Okay? Any questions? Yes, STF. Next algorithm is called SCAN. Okay, this is also called elevator scheduling. The reason it's called elevator scheduling is this is the algorithm works exactly the way elevators work. Okay, think of an elevator that's just going up and down. Okay. At any point, let's say there are people who are waiting to get in and they basically press the elevator button. Okay. So the way elevator schedules is request, it basically goes up, okay, and it picks up people, okay, and then it basically comes down and it does the same thing in the other direction. Okay. Same thing is happening here. So what the disk head does is it basically starts. Yeah, so it always basically sweeps. It goes back and forth. It starts from the innermost track. It starts sweeping outwards. Okay? And as and when it goes past the track where there's an outstanding request, it stops there. It services that request. And then it continues. So it goes all the way to the end. Okay? And then it starts a reverse scan. That's why it's called scan. It's just scanning back and forth. So it goes this way and then it basically stops wherever there are outstanding requests, services them and then moves on to the next request. Next, it goes all the way in and then starts a reverse scan. So it's just going back and forth, exactly the way elevators go up and down servicing people. Okay? Is this clear? Okay. So now if we are at position 30, okay, and we are going this way, okay, to our lower tracks, for track 0, that's track 100, then how are we going to service these requests? Which one would get scheduled next? 18, because there's only one request in this direction, which is 18. So there you have 40 here, 65 here, and 78 here. So it's going to go this way, go to 18, and then scan back, scan forward, and service these three requests. Okay, so you do 18 in this direction, and then you start scanning the other way, go to 40, 65, and 78. Yeah, yes, question.
Say instead of 18 you had like 41 and it was still going in that direction, would it go all the way to 0 before it started to go to 40?
Okay. So that's, there are two variants of this. There is one called scan, this other one called seek. Seek goes all the way to 0 even if there is no more request to be serviced. So it would go to 18 and even if there are more requests in this direction, it just keeps going all the way to 0. That's wasting work. Scan is smarter. It says I have gone to 18. It says do I need to go further? There is no other request, so let me turn back and go this way. Same thing what elevators do. They are, if there is no more request to be serviced on floors above, it's not going to go up for the sake of going up. Okay, so that's the difference between the two variants. We just pick the smarter variant. Okay, which basically says I don't have to go all the way to 0. Okay? Which is why, that's what I was going to say next, if you look at the distance for seek, you are at 30, you go to 18, So you have 12 tracks. If you are doing seek, you would go all the way to 0 and come back, and then you would add 36 tracks more before you actually go in the other direction. But this one does not do that. Okay, just say there are no more requests that way, so I'm going to scan this way, so it goes from 18 to 40, it's 22 tracks, and then 25, and so on. So it goes to 78, there's no more, so it will start a reverse sweep at this point. Okay? Is this clear? So this is actually the algorithm that this drives use. Okay, so if you buy a standard drive, this is the algorithm that's implemented on the hardware controller. Okay, so when requests come in, the disk head is just going back and forth, just servicing requests. It is very simple to implement. There's not much you have to do. You just maintain a list of which requests need to be serviced in the direction in which you are scanning, and just service them one at a time. Okay. It requires sorting. You need a sorted list, so you know when you are going in a certain direction, what's the next track you have to go to. Okay. But beyond that, you don't have to do much. Yeah, and that was a simple optimization, which is don't go all the way to the edge. Okay, if you do that, then the variant of this algorithm is called seek. Okay, but we'll just not worry about seek, we'll just do scan. Okay. Any questions on this? Okay. So the next variant is called circular scan. This one just scans in one direction. Okay, so assume that you have an elevator that basically only stops as it goes up. Okay, and then on the way down, it's not going to stop, it's just going to come all the way down and then again start a reverse scan. Okay, so it's basically only scanning in one direction. Okay, that's called circular scan. So if you look at what is said here, in this you go from 0 to 100 and then 100 to 0, 0 to 100. So you scan both directions. This one basically goes in one direction and just comes all the way back, but doesn't stop on the reverse, then again only services in the forward. Okay. Now you will see why this makes sense. Okay, but if you are doing this, then what would you do? So you are, let's say now you are at 30 going out. Okay, so you would go to 40, do 65, 78, and then you would come back to 18 and service it. Okay, so that's the order in which you are doing it. So 10, 25, 13, 16, that's 108 tracks. Okay. So the claim is, now what's the difference between scan and C-scan? Okay. You might think that when you are doing the reverse scan but not servicing requests, that may be bad in some sense, because you are already going past the track, there's an outstanding request there, why not wait there, service the request and move on? Why just go all the way back and do this? Okay, the reason for this is that if you actually do service requests only in one direction, the claim is that that results in more uniform wait times for requests. Okay, it is a more fair algorithm. Question is why? Why would wait times be more uniform if you service requests only in one direction? Yes.
The platter's circular.
Yes.
So if you do a C scan, you're not actually going all the way. It's not like an elevator where you have to go to the top floor, then travel all the way back down to the bottom. You go all the way up to the top floor, but then you just go one more round and you're back to the bottom again.
No, that's not true. This, think of this as the CD, right? This is the innermost track, that's the outermost track. So the platter is spinning. Let's say this is the disk head. The disk head is just moving this way. Okay? So it positions itself here and it can then read whatever is on this track, it can read. So what this thing is doing is it's going outwards and it's scanning. And on the reverse path, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't service any request. Comes all the way back to zero, then again starts scanning. So you're only basically, let's say these are the tracks. So you go wait here, service, then you go wait here, service. And on the way back, you don't service, even if there are outstanding requests. Go all the way to zero and then service outwards. Okay. Now question is, why would that result in a more uniform wait time? Yes.
Well, say if you just passed 18 and then you're now, you may have a request later on in the disk that you have to service. And then a request comes in exactly for 18 again when the disk has just passed. It still has to wait for a complete iteration of going up, and other requests coming back.
Right.
So it has to stop so that one that it passed that just came into it.
Right.
So we have to wait a lot longer than all the other requests come in.
Right. You had something to say?
I was just going to guess also that, like, principal, I guess, depends on where the head is at the time.
Yes. So it does depend on where the head is and which direction you are scanning. So assume for this to understand why it's uniform wait time, assume that when a request comes in, it picks a track at random. Okay, uniform random distribution. So let's suppose you are going this way. Okay? So it's like I'm throwing darts. Okay? The dart basically goes and hits a track, and that's the track I need the request on. And a dart can hit any track with a, say, equal probability. And as I scan forward, I just take the darts off the board of this platter. Let's assume that. So I'm going this way and I'm just clearing out the darts here. Okay, what do you expect? Where will the new incoming request hit the disk? Okay, suppose that I basically just finished a scan and I'm in this, I'm right here and I'm going to go back. What would the disk request look like in a uniform distribution? They have to be more to the left with higher probability because they can hit anywhere, and since I've just gone past these tracks, more likely that requests that are waiting here have been cleared, but since this has been a while since I went past this track, there are more likely that the requests are here. Okay? But if I service requests when I'm going back in the opposite direction, these requests have to wait longer because they are here, but they have to wait until a full scan is completed. But if I don't service requests on the way back and just go backward, then these requests get a better chance at getting serviced earlier. Okay? It's the same thing. Think about an elevator. Okay? If I basically, if the elevator has gone up, it's more likely that people who are waiting are on the lower floors. But if I now start stopping at each floor on the way down, people who have been waiting on the lower floors have to wait longer. Instead of the elevator just goes all the way down without servicing anyone and start servicing them on the way up, they wait lesser for a lesser time. Okay? Same thing. Okay? At the end of a pass, more requests are likely to be at the other end of the disk. Okay? With scan, these requests get serviced at the very end of the sweep. In C scan, they get serviced at the beginning of the scan because you just go all the way back and start servicing them. Okay, yes, question.
Between 78 and 18,
mm-hmm.
why don't you account for 78 to 100 and then 0 to 18
right.
instead of going backwards to 18?
So that was what I was saying. That's a simple optimization. If you do that, then you have this thing called seek, which goes all the way even if there are no more requests. An optimization is you go to 78 and say, do I need to continue? Are there any requests? There's nothing in that direction. It's all empty. So why should I go? I just turn back right away. Same thing now the elevator would do. If it's, let's say, a 100-story building, I'm on floor 78, and it's going up. If there is no other outstanding request for any of the higher floors, better for me to turn back down rather than go up and do nothing. Okay? So that's the optimization. Yes.
You said that it was better, like for example, the first floor, that's where all the requests come from, so it's better if they come first there and leave all the requests in the middle. What if there are like a lot of requests waiting to go up from in the middle floor?
Well, so that's basically when you're gone this way, the more likely that the requests are clustered here and it's sparser on this side, if they're uniform. So when you go this way, you are basically serving the more dense population of requests, right? Now, of course, that doesn't mean for any instantaneous arrival it's going to work. There may be a large cluster that has just arrived here. They still have to wait when you have to come back this way. Okay, but overall, in a random distribution, it's fair. Instantaneously, it may not look like it's the right thing to do. Okay. Any other questions on this? Okay. So, a couple of other optimizations we'll talk about. So, we basically, what have we done so far? So, we looked at four algorithms, okay, and overall we looked at this problem, okay, how to schedule disk operations to minimize disk head movement, and you'll see based on for different algorithms what the performance was. So this is effectively the performance of the algorithm, how much the disk head is moving. So FCFS 142, lower numbers are better obviously. SSTF we did 92, scan could do it in 72. This should show you that SSTF is not optimal. This is a counter example. Somebody says, why is SSTF not greedy but not optimal? This example just shows you because here is a different algorithm that can do better. Okay, for the same set of requests. Okay. And then C-scan did 108. Okay. So it doesn't mean that it has minimized disk head movement, it just means it's more fair. Okay, because it has more uniform wait time. Doesn't mean the wait times are all going to be necessarily lower. It's more uniform. Okay. So having looked at this, now what we will do is look at some optimizations for how to lay out data on disks and so on. Next question here.
How important would it be to make all the requests fair, vice making it with less seek time? Because okay. like we've seen on CSCAN and CSCAN, why would it be more important to be fair?
Right. So this basically is a standard problem in any computer system. There are two metrics typically that you want to optimize. There's interactivity or response time, and there is throughput. Okay. Throughput says how many requests per unit time am I servicing. This says what's the wait time of a request. Okay. If you minimize just seek time, you're optimizing throughput because you can service more requests. There's less wasted work, more requests get serviced. Okay. By making it more fair, you're making the system have better response time because or more uniform response times. Okay. Now, if you have an interactive system, okay, like you are doing, you're actually, let's say, editing files and so on, you want higher interactivity. It's not a throughput intensive system, it is interactive. You want the system to respond as quickly as possible to each individual request. Okay. But let's say you have a video server, okay, it's just or an audio server, it's just sending out lots of data. Okay. In that case, you want to optimize throughput. Okay. So I am not saying that one is necessarily better than the other. All I am saying, so this basically, the way to understand the statement here is that if you have an interactive system, then this is a better algorithm. If you have a throughput intensive system, then just minimizing disk head movement is all that you care about, not wait times. Because okay? You want to service as many requests as possible. So this is a video server is a good example. Video server is, you are reading lot of data, video files from disk. Okay, this is what a server at YouTube or any of these sites have to do. Okay? The goal there is to have a single server service as many clients as possible before it gets overloaded. Okay? So you want to minimize, not minimize wait times, but you want to maximize throughput. Okay? So this is nothing to do with disks in particular. This problem comes up in any aspect of system design. You always have to pick whether you want to have a high throughput system or a highly interactive system. They are not necessarily the same thing. An algorithm that optimizes this may not necessarily do the other, or vice versa. Ideally, you like both, okay, but so many times it's not possible. Okay, if you do one, you basically do it at the cost of the other. Okay, yes.
Could you start with minimizing or maximizing throughput so you have a lot of resources, and then if the resources get smaller, you have to focus on smaller?
No, I don't think that's necessarily true. You just have to say what kind of applications or users are you servicing. Okay. If this is a laptop where the user is sitting and writing code or doing web browsing or those kinds of things, your interactivity is more important. If this is a server application, okay, meaning for laptops and desktops and so on, where users sit, because users see the interactive, you perceive the system to be fast or slow, depending on how quickly it's responding to you. Okay, that's why you want to minimize or optimize response time. Okay. If it's a server class application, this is what you care about. If this is a web server, what you care about is that it serves as many requests per second as possible before it starts turning away requests. Okay. So it's really class of application or type of workload. Is it a, or if it's a batch workload or it's a throughput intensive workload, the throughput matters more than response times. So it's not like the metric will change. It is really what are you designing the system for. That's what really matters. Okay. So now here are two other optimizations on disk or rather data placement. Okay. So now so far we have looked at how do you minimize disk head movement. The other way to optimize it is to ensure that data that's accessed together, related data stored as close to one another as possible. Okay. So let's suppose that you have an empty disk. Okay, you just brought a brand new disk and you stuck it into your machine and you are beginning to create files on this disk. So more likely than not, any file you create is going to end up stored contiguously on that disk. There's no reason for the file system to scatter your blocks when they can be stored together. Okay, because it's an empty disk, it's not fragmented. You want to create a file with 10 blocks and there are 10 adjacent blocks free, the file system will just allocate those 10 blocks. Okay, so files tend to be stored contiguously when disks are relatively empty. But this doesn't necessarily help in many cases. So let me show you an example. Okay, why it doesn't help. Okay, so let's assume this is your disk platter. Okay, this is a track. Okay, let's say the track has four sectors. Sector A, B, C and D. Okay, let's assume for whatever reason when the file got created, it was stored on these four sectors. So it's basically this is block 0, block 1, block 2 and block 3. Okay, four blocks of the file. So let's assume that this is your whatever allocator.cc that you've written, and you open this file. Okay, the entire file has to be read from the disk. Okay, this requires the file system to send four requests to the disk. Okay, you will say read this block, which is on sector A, and read that block, and read that block. Okay. So how is the disk going to service it? It's first going to move the disk head here. Okay, it's going to wait until A spins by. Okay, so let's say A is spun by the disk head and you read block A. Okay. Next you have to read block B. Okay, now it so happens that there is going to be some latency between the time you actually read block A and look at the queue. Okay, the queue basically has A, B, C and D. Okay, so you just finish reading A request. Once you do that, you have to look at the queue and say, okay, next block is B. Okay. And when you finish reading A, the disk is continuing to spin. Okay. So what is going to happen to block B? So by the time you realize you have to read block B, the sector has already started and basically the disk head is going to be somewhere in the middle of sector B, not at the beginning of sector B. Okay. So you have to wait for one entire rotation until you can read sector B. So you stored blocks contiguously thinking this is good, but it is ending out to be not good because there is some latency between the time you read one sector and you actually look at the queue and figure out the next sector is right there, but the disk is all still spinning continuously, so it's already gone by and you are in the middle of the sector, not at the beginning of the sector. Okay. So contiguous allocation can actually hurt, not help, in scenarios like this. Okay. So what disks do is, rather than doing contiguous allocation, they do interleaved allocation. Interleaved allocation says, rather than storing blocks contiguously, pick every nth block, pick every second block or pick every third block and store it that way. Okay. So in this case, what you would do is you would store the first block here of the file. Then even if this sector is empty, you would store the second block here, okay, not there. Okay. This will allow you time so that when you read A and then you would try to read this block next, you still have the time to actually go process this, and then the disk, this block has sector hasn't spun by. Okay, that's called interleaving. So don't allocate blocks that are physically contiguous, but allocate blocks that are temporally contiguous. Okay, leave a gap in between to allow for the disk to do some processing. Okay, if you don't do that, then you will incur, there's no seek here. Okay, you're still on the right track, but you incur higher rotational latency. Okay. So if you want to optimize rotational latency, then you are better off doing interleaving blocks, meaning storing the blocks of the file every second or third sector rather than storing them contiguously. Okay. So this simple optimization helps quite a bit, okay, in terms of improving throughput. And many file systems actually use this. Okay. So you basically use every second or third block. Okay. Is this clear? What is the optimization, why it matters? Any questions here? Yes.
How do you know exactly how much time it takes to go to the queue and then come back so you can optimize that?
Well, you don't necessarily know, but given that either you have to look at the electronics and do measurement, okay, actually empirically measure it, but people have found that if you skip one or two sectors, that's enough. Because it's still doing checks in hardware. This is not doing any software processing here. This is a queue maintained in hardware. But you still, even hardware cannot operate with zero time, right? It still takes some time for it to look in the queue and figure out where the next thing is. So it's very small, but that small thing matters here. If the next sector begins immediately, you are basically out of luck. So a small gap is okay, is all that people have figured out. Every second or third sector seems to work. Okay, so that's the way. It's not, to think about it. You know, that's disk interleaving. The other thing you could do is called read ahead. Okay, this is another optimization that is frequently used. So, what happens in disk read ahead is basically you try to optimize the sequential nature of accesses for many files. If the file system figures out that you are accessing a file sequentially, it doesn't wait for you to send a request for the next block of the file. It goes ahead and reads it in and stores it in its memory buffers. Okay? So when the request comes in, the data has already been read. Okay? So you are going ahead of where the application is and reading data in anticipation of future requests. Okay? So this basically can also reduce the number of seeks or rotational latency depending on how the file is stored. Okay, it also reduces response time because you are prefetching data. Okay, the disk is prefetching. The file system is guessing what the application is likely to ask for next and reading that data ahead of time. Okay, if the guess is right, then you win. Okay, because the data is already there. Okay, but if you guessed wrong for some reason, you did wasted work. Okay, so you do this only for sequential access. Okay, so you basically check in what order have I accessed my blocks. Okay, if I start by requesting block 1 and block 2 and block 3, the file system says you are accessing blocks sequentially because I see the order in which you are making requests. So that looks like sequential access. So I'm going to go ahead and read ahead the next few blocks even before you ask. Okay, and if you continue to do this, it will continue to send more read ahead requests. Okay, and the moment you stop accessing sequentially, it will say, okay, I should stop because looks like you're not accessing it sequentially anymore. Okay, so you always try to guess depending on the type of access, and when it's sequential, you start prefetching data from the disk into memory. Okay, yes, question.
So I think you were saying the other day that that's how like streaming videos online work. And they like fill up before you're actually there. But they have it now so that like you can jump around inside what's already buffered.
Right.
And that might not be sequential, but how do they still know?
Okay, so there are two things here. One is reading, so you're asking about video files, right? Reading a video file from disk sequential. Yep. Typically. Because if you just start playing a movie and you play to the end, you are just reading the file sequentially and playing it out. Okay? What you are asking is not what is actually being read from disk, but at the client end, you have this slider bar. Right? So you basically, you are somewhere here in the movie, and some of this is still, that's actually come over the network, is still in memory. Okay? This is stored in memory, it's not stored on disk. So if you move the slider bar back, okay, it just goes and accesses this data that's already in memory and just starts playing it from that point. If you move it forward and this data hasn't come to you yet, then you send a new request saying, stop sending the next few blocks, instead go here and start playing from here. Okay, that's not sequential access. Okay. So sequential access doesn't mean that everything is sequential, but it's mostly sequential. Okay, you can move things around that break sequentiality. So any data that may have been prefetched will be wasted. Okay, but then again when you resume playback, it will be sequential again from that point on. Okay. Any other questions here? Yes, we have a question.
There should be more reads from application programs or from the OS loading and unloading process.
Where do reads come from? There will be a bit of both. I mean, the operating system maintains data structures on disk, but the assumption is most of the work is being done by the application. If you have lots of apps, they are reading and writing, then that's the one that's triggering most of the I/O. But you will always have some system-driven I/O. Okay. So this is all we are going to say as far as secondary storage is concerned, namely disk drives. There is an entire other class of storage that we will actually only spend one slide on, that's this slide. Okay. And that's called tertiary storage. Okay. Tertiary storage is basically typically storage that you use to back up data that's stored on disk. And you have many types of tertiary storage. You can have tape drives. Okay, so these are large spools that just record data that's coming in, and then you archive it for long term, and if there are crashes, then you can go back to it and so on. There are many other types of archives. Okay? People do archives on thumb drives. Okay? You basically want to back some small stuff up, you just stick a USB drive, you put it on a thumb drive and you take it. You have optical discs, okay, of which the CD and DVD ROMs are only one class, but there are entire other class of higher capacity optical drives which are called worm devices. Okay, write once, read many, and these are only meant for archive, long term archival, where you want to move data off disk and just store it somewhere. You don't want to lose it, but you don't feel like you need it online all the time. Okay, there are even robotic jukeboxes. Okay, just as you have music jukeboxes where you can basically pick a song and it picks the right CD and starts playing it, your robotic jukeboxes that do the same thing. It's a library of worm drives, and it has data, and then depending on what you are accessing, it will go pick the right platter, it will load it, and it will give you the data. Okay. So these are all forms of tertiary devices. Okay. And typically they are used for long term archival, they are used for backup purposes. Okay. Now what has happened is because the cost of disk drives, so at one point the reason this made sense was this, that disk drives were expensive. Okay. Tertiary storage was 1/10 the cost of disk drives. Okay, so if you look at dollars per gigabyte, okay, so typically disks cost $10 for each gigabyte, and tertiary storage was $1 a gigabyte. Okay, now disk prices have continued to fall as disks have become bigger and bigger. Okay, you can buy a one terabyte disk drive for your PC for a few hundred dollars now. Okay, so disk costs also have come down to $1 a gigabyte or less. So in modern enterprises, although there are still tape drives, what they have done is they use disks to back up other disks. Okay. In other words, some secondary storage is mirroring what's on some other secondary storage rather than using tape drives and whatnot. Okay. So the new generation of backups is basically to use more disks. Okay. So you basically have one side that is basically mirroring what's on some other side, and you might use cheaper drives. Here you might use on your main system, you might use high performance drives. Okay. On your backup system you can use cheaper drives because you just want to go back to that data in case there is a failure, but it's not servicing requests online all the time. Okay. So all modern enterprises basically have done away with a lot of these. They just use large disk farms, you know, which are called disk arrays or RAID arrays that you might have heard of, and one RAID array backs up another RAID array. Okay, this is primarily why we will not go into a lot of details here, but the only thing I want to mention is there is a storage hierarchy. Primary storage is basically main memory. Okay, secondary storage disk drive, and tertiary storage is anything that is going to be used as an archival medium. Okay. Traditionally that has been tape drives or optical discs, but today these are basically cheaper secondary storage that acts as your tertiary layer in your storage system. Okay. So that is basically what I have to say for today about discs. Now there are some review questions, you can go through it. One thing I want to say is the next programming assignment. Okay. So I haven't put this up yet. Okay, but just because you all came here, I thought I'll give you a sneak peek at what's coming. And I will come back to this on next Tuesday. Okay? So if you actually want to, this is going to be a repeat from an old programming assignment that I gave a long time ago. So the last assignment is going to be one where you write a small file system. Okay? So we will use the concepts we studied last class. Okay? And that's what you're going to implement. So your file system needs to have a disk, okay? But really you don't need a disk. What we'll do is we'll use a small file. Okay? So we'll create a file on your real disk and we'll use this file as a pseudo disk or a dummy disk. So what you'll do is rather than reading or writing to a real disk drive, you'll read or write to a file. Okay, the file will look like a disk as far as your file system is concerned. So this is your disk, which is essentially a file, and this is your file system. So you read or write. So your disk will, just as your disk could have n blocks, this file will have n blocks, and that will be the capacity of this file system. Okay. So all you have to do, okay, this is the layout of the disk. Okay, it has 128 blocks. Okay. The first block is what will be called a super block. This is reserved block. This is where you store all of the inodes and everything else for the rest of the blocks. Okay. The rest of the blocks will actually contain files. Yeah, this zeroth block is going to contain information about the rest of the disk. Okay. What's in the super block is a free block list. Okay. and we'll use a bitmap, exactly what we said last time. So for each block here, there's one bit. The bit is 1, that block is in use. If the bit is 0, that block is free. Okay? So that's, since there are 128 blocks, you will have, if you use the bitmap, this would be 128 bits, but we are going to make it 1 byte per block, okay? But you will only use 1 bit of that. So first 128 bytes of this first block is going to be the free block, and the next things are all the inodes. Okay? Each inode has a file name. Okay, file names in this file system can be only 8 characters long. You can't have longer file name. So file name is basically name 8. It has a size, which is a int. You have 8 block pointers. Okay. This is an indexed structure. Okay. So your file can have only 8 blocks. Okay. File cannot be greater than 8 blocks, and your pre-allocated is 8 blocks. Okay. So this array will store where the blocks of the file are on your disk. Okay. And then there is something, a bit saying, is that inode used or not. You can have only 6, you'll have 16 inodes in the super block, which means that you can have up to 16 files. Beyond 16 files, you can't store anything in your file system. Okay. Is the structure clear? Free block list, 16 inodes. One inode for each file that is going to get created. It'll have a file name, it'll have a file size. File can have at most 8 blocks, and you will have an array of 8 block pointers. Okay. And our thing. Actual data is going to be stored here. So what you really have to do, okay, is to implement a simple file system interface. Okay. You implement a create call. Okay, this allows you to create a new file on your file system. So the argument of the create call is a file name. Say create a file with this name, and this is the size of the file. So we'll assume that you pre-declare the size of the file. Okay. Typically this is not true in a real file system. You create a file and the file grows and shrinks. In this small file system, where you create the file and you specify the size at creation time, and the file system size, the file size cannot change once you create it. Okay? So the create call has a file name and a file size. You can have a delete call. You give the file name, that file gets deleted. Okay? And then there is a read and a write. Okay? Read allows you to read data that you stored in a file. So you specify the file name. You say, I want to read this block number. Okay? You can read one block at a time. And you specify a buffer. Okay? So you could say file foo block 5, and you give a buffer of 1 kilobyte, and your file system will read that block for that file and store it into this buffer, and you can read it out. And there's a write call that does the opposite. Okay? You basically say, here is the file name, this is the block I need to write to, and that's the buffer, and you write it out. Okay? The last call is ls, which lists all the files that you have stored in your file system. Okay, there's a single root directory. There's no directory structure other than one root directory. All files are at the root directory. So all that ls has to do is return a list of all the files and their file sizes. Okay? People are looking puzzled. Is this clear what I just said? I mean, we'll talk about this again. Okay? So, this is just to get you thinking. I know many of you haven't finished your current project. Yes?
Is that up on the site right now?
I will show you how to get to it. I haven't actually put it up. Okay, just one second. A couple of other things. Okay, so I will give you a program that will allow you to create a blank file system. This is like the format program. Okay, it will create a dummy file. It will create this structure. Okay, so initially the file system will have no file, so it will have all blank blocks, and it will have all of that free block list freed up and so on. Okay, that's the create file system program that we'll give to you. Okay, and here is a template that basically says this is what you have to write. You have to write a class called my class file system. Okay, and I actually provided detailed comments on what each function has to do. This is a create. It says go step 1, do this, step 2, do this, step 3, do this. You just have to fill out the code that does this. Okay. So there are 4 functions you have to write, actually 5. Create, delete, read, write, ls. Okay? And this is the skeleton for what you have to do for each of those functions. Okay? This project will not use an autograder. Okay? This is going to be, Sashi is your autograder. So no test cases. Yes. Alright, so don't try to submit anything. You will have to test this by yourself and just send it in at the end, and we'll hand grade it. Okay? So now I haven't put this up. Yeah, I will do that most likely tomorrow. So the way you get to it, okay, is I'll show it. So this is actually a repeat of an old assignment. So I'm going to point you to the old one until the one that we have comes up online. Okay, go to my webpage. Okay, and then go to teaching section, and there's a past courses archive there. Okay, click on that, and this is all a list of courses. So go to fall 2001. You'll see CompSci 377. So 8 years back we had this assignment. Okay, so you go there, you will basically land up on the web page for that course. Okay, and then just go to the lab section, lab materials, and there is lab 4 there. Okay, go and look at that lab. So what will be put up will be very similar to what's there, with almost no changes. But I haven't actually had the time to put it up. I just want to give it out for those of you who want to get an early start. Really assume that this is actually handed out next Tuesday. Okay, that's when the clock really starts ticking. It's like 5-day advance bonus for those of you who came in today. Alright? Okay, so let's stop here. So we'll resume in a week. Okay, have a good break. There is going to be a discussion section tomorrow for those of you who came in late. But that just